You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. Time now to talk movies, film, culture with Richard Leonard. Richard, welcome.
Thanks, John. It's lovely to be back.
Well, good to have you. And it's been, over recent weeks, we've seen the sort of rush of holiday movies from the United States, the summer blockbuster season, scarred, of course, by the terrible events surrounding the release of the Batman movie.
Incredibly tragic, very sad
indeed. In Colorado and Denver. But let's just talk first. We'll get on to that. But let's just talk about if there's any common threads that we can draw out of these movies. It started with Prometheus as the first. Then we had Spider-Man and then Batman. All came out sort of weeks after each other.
Well, the one thing we can say is they've spent an awful lot of money making them. Just a colossal amount of money goes into these films right now. We know that. But these
and they're all part of a cycle, aren't they? Each one of them is the latest in
a
cycle.
Well, if we just take Prometheus, which has been around for a while now, but is still up there, you know, people are still going to see it. And it was a terrific film in many regards. But these are now films that are costing $200 million to make. Now, that's obscene, really.
You've got to look for a return.
As much as I love the cinema and as much as I enjoy it, you know, is my entertainment worth $200 million to make? If it's a hit, as these three films are, then they go on to make a fortune. But ethically, you've got to start to ask yourself some questions. But putting that aside, when you said that they're a sequence, Prometheus probably has to be the oldest sequel in the world because Ridley Scott's the director. Well, 33 years ago, he made Alien, and now he's having another bite of the cherry, and I use that metaphor rather decidedly, because here we've got a very sort of womb-like creature. We've got an alien mother who has got pods and begetting things, and yet again we go into this extraordinary cave-like structure, which, you know, the Promethean
sort of biological
animal lives
in within. Yes, the whole structure is biological, even though they don't refer to that at any point in the film. I don't think
I can't remember them referring to it, no. But it's certainly there, and dare I say, like, full of puns tonight, but it's pregnant with all of these things. And Australia, of course, has one of the great experts on the alien films and therefore has a lot to say to Prometheus. The professor of cinema studies at Melbourne University is a woman, an extraordinary academic called Barbara Creed, and she wrote a book many years ago now called The Monstrous Feminine. And I really encourage our listeners to get it. Although it's an academic book and it would have bits of it which would be a bit heavy going for some, it's really, really good cinematic theory. And it basically goes like this, and I'm not going to do it justice, so if Barbara's listening now, please forgive me. But it goes like this, that the traditional image of a woman in a horror film was those early 1970s films where she was home alone in her bra and knickers, and next minute a guy with a mask, as in the Halloween films, attacks her and kills her. And then all of a sudden, by the mid to late 70s, of course, the feminist movement has now taken off in the United States and indeed around the world, including Australia. Then all of a sudden, we started to get another genre. And we started to get the genre of film of which 33 years ago, Alien became the archetypal, dare I say, again, pardon the puns, everybody, became the sort of film where now we had not just a woman who was being aggressed upon, but was now the aggressor. And in The Monstrous Feminine, Barbara Creed does a fantastic job at taking you through films that you will now read in a completely different light. And one of the things is the monstrous womb. And these men who get emasculated go in one after the other to try and deal with the alien or try and deal with the dreadful being that lives inside the ship, who has fallopian tube-like sort of characteristics and then begets
which
pods.
Which you get lost in.
You get lost in, and then it has to eat you up. And, of course, this has got extraordinary roots into Greek mythology and the Vagina Donata. And,
well, of course, Ridley Scott is consciously hitting you over the head with that, those links back to mythology with the very title Prometheus and the opening sequence of
the
film.
In fact, I felt slightly uncomfortable about how self-referential the film was, to be honest. It's almost as though he hasn't finished saying what he wanted to say. But while I think I got Alien, I wasn't sure what he was trying to say here, though I just strapped myself in for the 3D ride and off we went.
Well, that's the other point of it, isn't it? And I think most critics have picked this up, that the film actually loses itself intellectually and in some ways in terms of the power of the plot, but you're sustained by Ridley Scott's mastery of technique. And particularly with 3D, you just sit there in awe. In some ways, the 3D becomes transparent. You are no longer conscious of the 3D, yet you are held by its power.
Yes, these are films which must be seen on 3D. There are three films right now that if you haven't seen them at all, or if you haven't seen them in 3D, I can be fairly cynical about 3D. I just think it's a bit of a gimmick generally. But these ones work, and they would be Batman, the new Batman film, which we'll come to talk about, Prometheus, and even the Spider-Man film. It came out in 3D as well. Now, you can see it in 2D, but the 3D is very exciting, and it's very well done. And we want to give the director a lot of credit, but I also want to give a credit to the director of photography of these films. They're often the forgotten people, but they're the ones who obviously are nailing this craft and really being able to give us shots and experiences, which are quite breathtaking, and draw you in. The other person that goes with this is, once you give people an extraordinary visual experience in the cinema, you've got to give them a great audio experience. So the sound design of these films, it's always been wonderful, and we've had sensor out sound and all of those things, but it's now getting better and better and more effective. And I must admit, in Prometheus, they literally get lost inside of this mountain, which hides the womb-like creature, which they have to kill, and there are no spoilers in there so far, but then also the sound literally encases you as well. So visually, experientially, and orally, you are encased in this film, and in a very good way. It's a bit claustrophobic, but it's good.
Before we leave Prometheus, how do you rate a film like that? It becomes very difficult to rate them, doesn't it? Because you can say, look, intellectually it loses its way, but nevertheless it sustains... Scott is trying to pick up elements of a story that have been there since the start, as you said,
yes,
the monstrous
Alien.
Feminine stuff, and all through the Alien archetype. Yet most people would say, look, I was able to forgive all that stuff because it was just such a wonderful cinematic experience.
Yes, that's right. But the thing I really annoys me about...
How do you rate those films?
Well, where I'm lost a lot with these films is they're always looking to the sequel. And Prometheus gives us the sequel... Batman gives us the sequel, although he says that's the end of the trilogy. Well, we can't say any more about that. It'll be in very big trouble. Spider-Man, they'll probably have another go. And, of course, the more money they make, producers are sitting there salivating, saying, let's go again. And, you know, we even get The Hangover Part 2. Well, The Hangover Part 3 is on the way. And so it's always, not that I'm putting The Hangover with these films, but it is the sequel that annoys me, because you know that the storyline is going to leave you with our hero or our heroine having to go back. And I don't think the best writing ever is one which is always leading to trying to get you to back. That was the old serial matinee show that left you with the cliffhanger, so you came back.
The car going over the cliff, where is our hero? Yes. Mm.
So they end up a little not as satisfying as they could be.
Let's talk a bit more about Batman. We have to talk about it through the lens of what happened in Colorado and the sort of cries again about cinema and its relationship to violence.
Yes.
Now, of course, that's also linked to the monstrous feminine you alluded
to, indeed.
In Alien, the way we handle violence.
I'm not sure we quite finished that, and I would like to, because, you know, the theory goes that wasn't it a surprise that these men in the late 70s, early 80s and since have written all of these screenplays, whether consciously or subconsciously, they're against monstrous womb-like creatures that were trying to take charge of men and men's affairs and were more powerful than men, and ended up either Sigourney Weaver with a shaved head, so she looked like a male, though she's the heroine of that first film, or now where the men are attacking this monstrous feminine. So there's a good body of literature to say this is in reaction to the assertion against father law of patriarchy, and so they're reactive films. Batman's not in that brigade. Batman is a total vigilante. It's all about vigilante justice, as good as he ends up being and as lovely as he often is on the way through.
But there is a sop to the... vigilante justice is usually associated with the political right. In the case of Batman in the Nolan films, there is a soft nod towards the left. That is, he's doing it in the interests of community good.
Yes, I actually got very confused in the Nolan films, to be honest, and really confused with this one as well, because there are two types of violence in this latest Batman film. There's the violent overthrow. There's the sort of social violence of terrorism. That's obviously pregnant within it. And we get that this was hatched by a man called Bane, who lived in a pit in the middle of the Middle East at some stage. So, you know, we have all of those dreadful Arabian ideas going on there. And secondly, though, and I found this more provocative and a bit more surprisingly, I've got to say this time around, there's the terrorism of the finance markets. And he has some pretty awful things to say about stockbrokers. So if you're a stockbroker, don't go and see it. You're going to be very angry. And there's a chilling scene in retrospect, given, you know, James Holmes, who's the alleged killer in Colorado. There's a chilling scene at the towards the beginning of the film of Batman, this present one, where the baddies, led by Bane, go into Gotham City's stock exchange and mow everybody down, or at least they try to mow everybody down. In retrospect, that became a chilling scene. And when I saw it, I've seen it twice. I saw it when it first came out and just the other day in preparation for today. I've got to say that seeing an exit door to the immediate, my left of the screen, became a chilling experience, because now I'm sitting in a theatre knowing that at one other screening of this film, a person emerged through that door and started to attack the audience. That became a moment I've never thought about before. And given the horrible experience in Colorado, you became conscious that this was anything but fantastic violence happening on the scene. It became for scores of people a horrendous, or hundreds of people, a horrendous experience, and some lost their lives.
Let's talk about the link between cinema and violence. But before we do that, one other very pointed political allusion, given this is the presidential election season, is the name Bain, of course, associated with Mitt Romney's company, Bain Capital, which is going to be the foil for
John.
Mitt
I haven't
for,
haven't seen that till now. I think we should be on Planet America, you and I. At least you should be, because I didn't see that, but I get it now. It's there.
What characterises the Batman movie, not so much Prometheus, but the Batman movie and Spider-Man, is the sort of spectacular use of violence, the comic strip violence, the zap, bam, pow violence. Cinema and violence is a topic that constantly gets rehashed, yet this zap, bam, pow violence seems to stand apart. It's as if we actually are prepared to acknowledge that some forms of violence people can treat as comic book. Other forms of violence, no, we have to take seriously. They're either cathartic or they are, in fact, destructive.
Yes. I think there are a couple of points to be made here. The first is that some stories just are violent of their nature and appropriately violent of their nature. For instance, who could watch Steven Spielberg's film on the Holocaust, Schindler's List, and not have a violent scene? You're just going to have violence, because it was a horrendous chapter of violence. I think the audience contract that they make with the screen when they go to see these films is they know what they're up to, because, you know, this is a film with appropriate levels of violence. The second is where we have mechanized violence or futuristic violence, and that's where it can be the, you know, the bam pow sort of stuff, because it's so unreal. The contract with the audience is already futuristic. It's already in no way in touch with any sort of real experience now. The third is where it is. It may well be set in the future, but like this film, it's making lots of commentary about what's going on now, and people could actually imagine some of this happening here and now. That becomes a much more complex relationship between the audience and what's on the screen for violence. There's a couple of problems. The first is that when we have terrible events like have happened in Colorado, when we had Martin Bryant, who we know from his Supreme Court murder case that he watched a lot of violent material and particularly played violent video games. And we know with Andreas Breivik on the island in Norway and in Oslo itself, he too, we now know, watched a lot of violent video games and watched violent films. People immediately want to make a cause and effect moment. If you watch violent material, you'll become a violent person. The problem is there are about 28 longevity studies at the moment looking at the effects of media violence in the Western world. And I read at least 12 of these and stay on top of this stuff because I am very interested in it. None of them can find the cause and effect. It's just too neat. Now, as a Jesuit priest, I am the last person to forgive the cinema or the media generally and makers of video games for their responsibility in doing some absolutely dreadful things and the culture of violence that it can create. But we can't simply say, if you watch violent material, you'll become a violent person. It's exactly the same as saying, if you watch Westerns, you'll become a cowboy. It's a silly statement and it can't be proved. What we can say, and Baroness Susan Greenfield at the University of Oxford, the neurologist, she is without question the one who's leading the charge, though she has many critics, I've got to say, but I like her work, and she's the one who's looking at the link between young adults, young adolescents really, from 13 to 18, who play a lot of video games. That's the particular area she's interested in, neurology and the effects that has on the brain. She has been able to substantially prove already that their empathetic response to real life violence, when she gets them back in to have a look at how do they respond not to cinematic or play violence, how do they react to real life violence? So I don't know what she shows, but I assume she shows them torture and war scenes and things like that. Their empathetic response, even physically as well as psychologically, is significantly different from her control group who aren't exposed to this violence, who don't play this violence. So already we know we can prove that there's a different empathetic response. And as a former secondary school teacher and teachers who are listening to us right now, they'll know we know that from our own experience in a playground.
Could it not be, though, that the frame of violence or the violent scenes in movies are in fact a template or providing a frame for something else, and that is they are symbols of an attitude of mind which says, I want simple and direct solutions to things in life. Yes. So whip out the gun, kill the guy, bash the guy in the head. So if you follow a theme, say, from the Rambo movies through, you get this attitude that, we don't need the complex politics to sort things out. We just need a guy and a gun and go in there and clean the buggers out.
Yes, I the solution is one thing, but the other thing to look at is that the goodies and baddies are clearly delineated, that we know very early on, you know, there's always somebody who is a traitor, but early on, you know, these are the shining white knights and these are the baddies, and there's a messiah figure. The Batman thing, Spider-Man, all of the Marvel comics all rest on wanting a messiah, one person who is going to come along and save us from ourselves. The problem with those films, of course, politically, as we now know, is that, you know, the military, the police, the clergy, trade union officials, politicians are all complex, very complex organisations within which some very good people do wonderful things for the community. And as I know, as a Catholic priest, some terribly evil things have been done from some people who should not have done them. So the goodies and the baddies aren't as clear. They are on the screen, but they're not in real life.
It's also been suggested in terms of the Western paradigm and the cowboy that that plays into what happened in Denver in that, not that the cowboy goes in and shoots them up, but there is an attitude as you move further west in the United States from the civilized, quiet East, which is similar to Europe, through across to the West, which has this more open frontier, we are the law attitude. So it's not about violence. The violence is actually the sort of symbolic of, or it betokens, a general cultural attitude.
Well, they've done a lot of work, of course, on Westerns. There's just libraries of cinematic theory to do with Westerns. And the two big themes that emerge, that when you look at the classic American Western, it either protects property or protects a woman and children. And then it's often revenge. It's about payback. So you either have to maintain the law of the town, so the sheriff ends up having to maintain the law. He is the law embodiment, and there's summary justice immediately because they didn't have many other options. Or often the cowboy's wife or children have been killed, and then all of a sudden you've got to go back and get revenge. Of course, there's a terrible colonial thing that went on in these films, which was all about, you know, the white Western man who was up against the smart indigenous Indian, and pretty appalling racial stuff was going on in those, except then a film like Forgiven comes along with Clint Eastwood, which started to change the dynamics of it. So what we do need to say, though, about the Colorado thing is that a lot of American, conservative American public and politicians, and not even conservatives, I'm both on the left and right, can have a long discussion about how media violence leads to James Holmes' alleged behaviour, and they won't talk about gun ownership and ammunitions and the sort of arsenal that a young man like that, who's obviously, well, not obviously, he's got to be diagnosed, but I assume he's mentally ill. And
yes, and an automatic weapon can kill a lot more people than a knife.
That's right. And also, we don't want to stereotype mental illness. Not all mental illness will lead to violent, like, I'm not making that link, but there are some forms of mental illness which, untreated, undiagnosed, do lead to some very deviant criminal and indeed destructive behaviour. And somehow, you know, we've got to have that discussion too, and the media can become, or at least cinematic and computer game violence can become a much easier scapegoat than having the tougher conversation.
Well, let's talk about another aspect of violence, that is that sort of violence in the cinema, which is cathartic and ultimately therapeutic, that it is a good thing to have been through that experience, distasteful as it is. And I guess the best example that might resonate in people's minds is that wonderful, frighteningly profound New Zealand film from a decade ago, Once Were Warriors. You can't come out of that movie and have been drenched in the violence of it without having some cathartic effect on you.
No, in fact, in my book, Movies That Matter, I write about that film and I write about violence in general, but it is an extraordinarily important film. One, because what I'd like most of our listeners to remember right now is for all of our talk about violence in the cinema, let's have a chat about the violence we don't show, because that's as instructive and as revealing of a Western mindset as that which we do show. So, for instance, the most common form of violence that is experienced in the community is domestic violence. It is the least shown on television and film. Now, isn't that interesting? Mm. The Institute for Criminal Studies last year told us that in Australia, 46% of all police call-outs are to domestically violent situations. Now, that's unbelievable, 46%. And yet it's not shown anything like that. For in a classroom, in any gathering of any group, domestic violence is going to be the most common. There aren't that many pantyhose killers and there aren't that many serial murderers. They're on television every second night. But isn't it fascinating that we still won't have the discussion, we still won't show in any way that would reflect back to the culture what's actually going on in the suburbs, which is no respecter of class, no respecter of money, and no respecter of position in society. So domestic violence permeates every single section of our society, least shown on television. Back to Once Were Warriors, that's what made it so wonderful, that it really lifted the lid on domestic violence, on how that was actually generational, that there had been generations of this family, that's how they resolve conflicts. And then that wonderful make or break moment where the mother just says, my children are worth more than the degradation and the lack of dignity that had come with this. There was also in that film sexual abuse and an incestuous relationship. So there are a number of other themes that were going on there. But I think it's fascinating that except for Once Were Warriors, One Home and Away, One Neighbours, One Law and Order, like it comes up along the line. I'm not saying it's never treated, but in any way like it's actually experienced in the suburbs, the violence that's not on our screens is as instructive of the culture as the violence that is. When I work with teachers in schools, I often say, when was the last time you put the domestic violence helpline in your school newsletter? When was the last time you got somebody in to talk to the assembly, whether it be all boys, all girls or co-ed, doesn't matter, about domestic violence? And when was the last time you wrote home to the parents about domestic violence? Because there's a bit of a secrecy, there's a bit of an under-the-cover thing that permeates every part of our community, including our media community. And I think we should do something about that.
Richard Leonard, a salutary point on which to end our discussion.
Yes, it's been a rather bleak night tonight, but, you know, we can't have lived through these recent weeks without having to face some tough issues that are connected to violence and media violence one way or the other.
Father Richard Leonard, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday night.
It's a great pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.